This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. And this week we are sponsored once again by BDoc's Timeline 3D, a 3D timeline building application for iOS and also macOS 10. And later on in the show today, we are going to be announcing a competition along with BDoc's that will win you... Tell me what we're going to win, Bradley.
We've got three things that you can win. A copy of Timeline 3D for Mac, Timeline 3D for iOS, and a $25 App Store gift card.
Okay, awesome. So, how's your week been so far?
It's been great. It's been great. We have about a week and a half until Christmas break, and then we will be out for a few weeks. It's funny, our teachers, we have like a day or two less, and our teachers were kind of... You're grumbling about it. And of course, I come from, in some ways, a corporate world background before education. And I remember the days of getting 2 days off rather than 2 weeks. And so I would get 2 weeks for the entire year. So I quickly reminded them that we are much better off than most of the people in the world.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. We're, I guess, in common with most of the Western world, practicing for Christmas plays at school right now. So that was taking up most of our primary school time. We had a visit today. We have a regular monthly visit schedule that we have to the school, and that was today for us as well. So I've kind of been talking all day, and now it's the evening, and I'm talking again. In between times, I spent some time training some teachers at another school today. And my colleague Andrew Jewell and I both went, and we took sort of two separate classes at once. And I did the absolute beginner's class, which is always a joy. And Andrew did a sort of more intermediate class, but I literally started with the here are the parts of the iPad, this is the power switch, and then we sort of went on from there. So that was my after school activity today.
Well, I think that's a healthy thing to go over on occasion. We often just think, okay, the iPad is easy, you should know how it works, but there is times when you say, here's the home button, here is the volume switch. Here are the volume buttons. And so have you ever thought about at a music concert before they come, they say, okay, in my dressing room, I want this food, these drinks, and, a TV. You could say, all right, before I come to your school, I want a $25 iTunes gift card. I want an iPad mini with LTE to use while I'm there. And just make your demands and say, I don't know.
My demands rise to, can I please get on your Wi-Fi?
That's true. Can you give me unencumbered access to the internet? That is all I ask. I just want to get on the internet.
To which the answer was no.
Well, that's usually the case.
But, it's increasingly hard when you do those kind of things. You go to schools and they want you to do an iPad training thing or something, and they're not allowed to put iPads on the Wi-Fi or something like that. It's a deal breaker for the event, because... It's just so hard to kind of demonstrate the device to its full potential without good internet access,
Well, I'm quickly reminded, if I'm never not on Wi-Fi, how ultimately useless my iPad mini is, because it's a Wi-Fi only device. And it's just, I can read a couple of Instapaper articles and that's about it. All the applications that I use require constant access to the internet. A Tweetbot is not much good without access to the internet.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I actually got that question at the end of my session today, and one of the teachers asked me, she said, I don't have Wi-Fi at home, which initially surprised me, but anyway, she said, what can I do with this device if I'm not on the internet? And actually, given the things that I had talked about, and bear in mind I was talking about the beginner's class and we were not talking things like Twitter clients and Evernote and things like that, Google Docs or whatever. It was interesting just how much I could say. When you talk about Keynote and Pages and Numbers, which was kind of the level we were talking about, the iCloud model versus, for example, the Google Docs model. Now, I know Google Docs is offline support, but it's not as complete as you might want. There's a lot you can do with those apps, even if you are completely offline. So it was interesting to just reflect on those kind of basic questions again and go from there. The one thing that seems that was really popular in the session that I did were two things. One was the multitasking gestures, the four-finger swipe and the pinch and so on. Those sound like wrestling moves, but they're in fact things that you can do on your iPad. those are really, really useful things for beginners to know about. And also, what we just, I always do with beginning iOS users is go over in detail, number one, how to efficiently edit text on iOS, you know, using the magnification loop, placing the selection cursor, using the edit menu that pops up. And then the other thing was the keyboard. And I was talking to quite a few modern language teachers today and just showing them the accented characters on iOS. So you push and hold the E key, for example, you get all your options popping up and you choose the one you want. That is a revelation to people who teach modern languages. And quite often, the most delight I had in today and yesterday, the two sessions I did, was when I taught people how to do the swiping up on the comma key trick to get an apostrophe. That was there were actually squeals of delight in the room when that was really revealed to them. And I guess that's the pain of gestures, is that they're not particularly discoverable if you don't know that they're there. But once people learn them, they make them their own.
Yeah, I have those same moments when I'm using keyboard shortcuts. I'll, you know, Command Tab, Command A on the Mac, and the teachers will be like, "Wait a minute, what did you do?" And then, mm-hmm. you know, that when people really see how valuable keyboard shortcuts and gestures can be in time saving, they're wonderful. The key is for them to take the time to learn them, and that's where if your school is trying to use, you know, 30 applications. That is can be tricky, but if you say, "Hey, we use these two applications in our school," then you can kind of wear those out, and as the years go on, you take your teachers deeper and deeper into what it can do.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, in light of what we're kind of going to talk about, that just to kind of come afresh to iOS and hear what people who are coming from essentially a desktop PC kind of world, the way that they perceive the limitations and the possibilities of iOS. Because I guess what we're going to kind of chat about today, which is not going to be a terribly long show, I don't think, but just thinking about where does iOS need to go next? You know, how does it, where can we go from iOS 6, which is a pretty rich release, pretty feature complete in terms of most of the basics, but where do we go next? What's the next frontier for iOS? And I think certainly discoverability of some of these more advanced features is one of them.
I think we're at the same place with the Mac, that it's less about what does Apple need to put in and more about what applications do we need. They've been these systems have been refined over the years. And, you know, one of the things for me, it's kind of at the bottom of my thoughts on iOS, where it needs to go. But I think the overarching thing for me is to keep it simple. Because that's ultimately why iOS is so successful, is that it's so easy to pick up the basics, much more so than the Mac, in my opinion. And so that's Apple's challenge, is how do you expand the feature set to give more usability to power users, but also keeping it simple?
Yeah, we're hitting into a period of an incredibly fine balancing act for iOS, because as the devices get more powerful, you know, in the world of iPad 1 and iPhone 3G and original iPhone, the devices were so weak and so short on memory and so on that there were only certain problem sets that you could attack. But now that the devices have become substantially more powerful, you know, they're four times more powerful than they used to be, there are now bigger problem sets that you can attack. And you can start to try and think about, well, maybe we could do some CAD stuff on iOS, or maybe we could do, you know, 3D printing or whatever from our iPad. And those more complex applications and tasks that you're trying to attack, I think, could lead iOS down a world where it gets harder to learn. Maybe, maybe not. But I think already, even from my experience from going from iOS 3.2, which was the first iOS we brought into the school, to iOS 5 and 6, the setup is absolutely essential to get right. And one of the things I've found over time is that I'm finding more and more people, not so much in my school because our setups have been done for several years, but new users to iOS, they quite often what I'm finding is that devices are set up in the most appallingly wrong fashion. And I mean that in terms of things like, which Apple ID are they using? Oh, well, I'm using different Apple IDs, and I was sharing my iCloud login with my daughter, and now their stuff synced onto my account and my stuff. And the extraction of all of those things is incredibly difficult. You know, to unpick a commingled account from two people sharing it is really, really difficult. So I think there's definitely work to be done in the setup phase. And I think it's simple if you have a mentality of keeping it simple. But what I find is that people who, I don't want to say this in a pejorative sense, but people who try and think they can second guess or beat the system quite often run into difficult problems. You know, people who've got themselves a US account and a UK account, for example, and they're jumping between them until they hit, they get caught for doing that, and the limits that are applied to those different accounts start biting on them. Do you see that? Is that a regular thing you see? I feel like I see that all the time there.
I get that question a lot, especially like I will get it a lot come next month. And so a common scenario is, let's say some of our school parents, they each have iPhones and they're sharing iCloud accounts, which I would disagree that they need to do. I have a solution for family setups, but then, you know, little Bobby Sue will get an iPad or an iPod Touch for Christmas, and then they will just use that same account, and all the data is on the same places. So then iMessage starts syncing everywhere, and it really becomes a mess. And on top of that, I'm seeing a lot of people that either don't, like when they see the iCloud setup, they'll think, okay, I don't have to do that, and they won't do it. Well, then they never back up. And so I would love to see in some ways a kind of reminder, hey, you're not backing up your phone anywhere, because that's really the worst place. I had a coworker that their daughter did not use iCloud. And so she would sync to the Mac and did not import and really didn't import her photos into iPhoto. She had like 2,000 pictures on her camera or on her camera roll. Well, she went to import them and had checked the box like, you know, delete after import. Well, iPhoto crashed and it, you know, she didn't have any either copies. They were all gone. And so she thought she had lost 1,700 photos. She said, but I was syncing to iTunes. So I kind of just did some thinking and I saw she had a backup from the day before. So, okay, let's restore from that backup. And we restored from that backup and it got our camera roll back. Mm-hmm. Of course, the first thing we did was turn on iCloud backup and get those pictures off her phone to, you know, into iPhoto or into the Finder actually. And I see that a lot, just the you know, management of getting stuff on and off. I think it is simple to, you know, to sync to a computer and things like that, but getting some of the data on and off isn't always simple, especially with photos.
Yeah. And this is one of the things that I think, you know, if there's something that I would like Tim Cook to kind of step up and do a better job on, it's, do you remember, you know, years ago when Steve Jobs articulated what became known as the digital hub strategy, where you have all these peripherals, you have your camera and your MP3 player and all this kind of stuff, and how do you get data onto them? Well, the strategy was that the computer became the hub of your digital lifestyle. And I think that was of a previous era, and iCloud now takes the place of the computer in that model. But what I find over and over again is that people don't understand the cloud. They don't understand it as a phrase. They don't understand it as a concept. And because iCloud is both a marketing term and sometimes a feature, people often get very confused. I keep getting questions about, well, is that the cloud? Is this the cloud? You know, because in sometimes also it's so well integrated into applications that people don't realize that what is happening here is happening through iCloud. Example might be how do you sync your iBooks page positions between devices? Oh, well, that goes through your iCloud account, but it doesn't say on your iBooks interface syncing through iCloud with a big button. You know, it just does it, which is great when you understand that that's how it's happening and that's the conduit and that's where the data is going and that's the credentials that are getting it from one place to another. But I think in large part, in some ways, the iCloud stuff has been sort of too well integrated into certain apps that it happens and people don't understand why it's happening. Therefore, they think that, oh, well, the iCloud is just this thing that backs up my computer. Why can't we share that or whatever, you know? And it's there's a story to be told there that I think is not being articulated absolutely to its maximum in such or in a, such a simple way that the ordinary person can really understand.
Well, and it works on an iCloud as a digital hub, works in certain aspects of iOS and the Mac. And so an app like Byword, where it has iCloud syncing, it truly is the center. iCloud is the center. Okay, but what do most people have on their phone? They've got apps, they've got music, and then they've got, you know, photos and video. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, apps to me is in my head probably like the least common thing. So we've got the least amount of data. So, you know, think about regular people. They may use the Notes application and that's fine. Or if they use an app like Evernote, it's got its own syncing mechanism. But then, of course, music is handled with iTunes Match, which I think they have done a somewhat good job of explaining it and marketing it. And it from I did not resubscribe, but it wasn't because it didn't work. It's just because I don't listen to a ton of music on my phone. I mainly listen to music at my computer, and I listen to podcasts on my phone, as should all of our listeners. They should be listening to our past episodes.
Absolutely.
But just kidding. But to me, where this falls down is with photos and video. Okay, so we've got PhotoStream. So I got two texts this week from two different friends. How long do photos stay on PhotoStream? Okay, so it's 30 days or the 1,000th most recent photos. Okay, I think that's what I read. Okay, but that doesn't include video. So to get video off, you still have to sync. But if you just sync, most people think syncing is syncing to iTunes. And they assume that then the videos are getting stored somewhere. But they're not. To get the videos off, you must then open up either Image Capture or iPhoto and grab the videos off. And so, and I'm not saying, I mean, I have a 40 to 60 gig photo and video library. I'm not saying it's feasible for Apple to store all of that in iCloud, and in some ways, nor would I want them to. But I think there is a happy medium between that to where, you know, there is no way to get videos off without using an app like Dropbox or a third-party app, especially if it's a long, high-def movie that you've recorded. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of confusing. So iCloud does your app syncing with data. It syncs your place in your iBooks, and it can get some of your photos, but doesn't get your videos. And if your photos are older than 30 days, then it may not have those. But your photos are backed up to iCloud, though, on your camera roll. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I think in some ways you could... I can see a future in which iCloud does everything. And it is really just a matter of the cost of storage, the cost of bandwidth, and whether... You know, upstream bandwidth becomes reasonably fast for most people. You know, and I think all of those things are going to increase and or decrease. You know, the cost of storage will decrease, the bandwidth available will increase, and there could come a day in which, you know, literally, you know, it's a Backblaze style thing where, you know, just all of the contents of your iPad gets sucked up to the cloud. You know, if PhotoStream supported video, we would be a bit further along with this, and so on and so on. But I think. I disagree with you a little bit that iTunes Match is understandable to most people. I think the name is not absolutely clear what it means. And of course, iTunes is now a prefix to so many things. You know, iTunes U, iTunes Store, iTunes Gift Card, and so on and so on. I think that people are confused. I know that people are confused between like syncing your iTunes library up to the cloud versus being able to re-download songs that you bought from the store. And I think because it's also different for different media as well, it would be nice to see... I mean, this is not so much, you know, where does iOS have to go, but this is where... You know, let me correct that. iCloud is absolutely the heart of, you know, the functionality of iOS and the Mac right now. And I think the messaging around that has to become clearer, possibly simpler, possibly more explicit in terms of this is an iCloud thing that's happening right now. Either that or the other way could go and probably should go this way is that it just has to become completely invisible, right? It just has to work for all corner cases, all edge cases, no exceptions. Everything just works. And we're neither one thing nor the other right now. It's not clear to people that things like iBooks are syncing through iCloud because some parts of it sync and some parts don't. For example, if you sideload an EPUB into your phone, it's not going to sync across to your iPad, whereas the page positions of both would if you loaded the book separately. You know, things like that. Do you see what I mean? Does that make sense?
No, I agree. You know? And that, I mean, because I think I bought an ebook from somewhere the other day that was an independent author. And so they actually sent me the EPUB to my email. Well, I know that I could just do the open end into iBooks, but I said, wait a minute. I feel like something's going to get out of sync. So I waited till I got to my computer to import it into iTunes and then sync it to my devices. Like ideally, like you do in Evernote, if I open that in Evernote, it just is on my other Evernote devices. That's probably like in some ways the way it should work.
Yeah, I think it has to be everything. It's either seamless or the seams have to become obvious. I'm not sure which I think is better. I would like seamless, but is that achievable? Possibly not. Therefore, perhaps it has to just become clear. This is an iCloud thing that's happening. That's an iCloud thing. And I know there's an alert the first time you run iBooks. Do you want to sync through iCloud? Yes, okay. But nobody remembers that the fifth time. And people probably don't even read it the first time as well.
And then what happens if the syncing stops working? What do you do?
Well, you know, isn't that that's a million-dollar question about the cloud is what do you do when it breaks? Because the logs aren't happening on your device. Typically, they're happening on the server somewhere.
And I always feel like that we bash Apple on this. Nobody else is getting all this right. I mean, this is a common problem across the industry. If somebody had all this seamless and covered all the edge cases, that would be incredible. But no one's got this perfect.
Yeah, Michael Lopp had a good article in Rands and Repose about how what it is that makes Dropbox so successful is that it is essentially quite stupid, that all it is a folder that syncs. It doesn't have very sophisticated conflict. It has conflict detection, yes, but what it will do is it will just say, here's your file and here's your conflicted copy. You deal with that. You know, you rename them, however. Dropbox does a good job, but we were having this conversation in the car on the way home today that Dropbox is feeling increasingly like a legacy product because the user experience on iOS is just not up to scratch because it doesn't. And this is the one thing I wanted to mention in terms of where iOS needs to go. The round tripping of data between applications and iOS is just far too difficult. And I think that's kind of killing off Dropbox for me because the ability to take something out of Dropbox, edit it on the iPad and put it back in Dropbox is incredibly dependent on every step in that chain. And it's also quite clumsy and quite slow and you have to kind of do a lot of janitorial work to clear that up afterwards. Whereas with iCloud, you just hit the home button and you're done.
Yeah, I agree with you. It feels like it's a bridge from the centralized desktop world to moving to where the cloud is the king. Why don't we take a quick sponsor break if you don't care?
Okay.
Really excited to have BDocs back this week sponsoring the show. Of course, we've talked about them for the past few weeks. They've got their great 3D timeline applications for the Mac, for the iPhone, and the iPad, and they're just incredible. But one of the things they're doing announcing on the show, and they're going to be launching on their social outlets, is we got a contest that we want a true story of innovation telling how timelines were used in a classroom to engage students. So this could really be anything, you know, anything in education where you have you've used these products or use a similar product to really tell a great story. And so what you do, you tell your story, send it to story, STORY @bdocs.com. And we'll choose one to read on the podcast and it'll also be on the BDocs blog. And if you're the winner, you will receive a license for Timeline 3D for Mac. It's a $65 value, a license for Timeline 3D for iOS. It's a $15 value and it's a universal application. And then a $25 App Store gift card. Now, if you already own one of the BDocs products, you'll be able to transfer a license to a colleague or a friend. So again, we want a true story of innovation telling how timelines were used in a classroom to engage students. Send it to story@bdocs.com. Again, this can include using Timeline 3D for Mac, Timeline 3D for iOS, or any other Timeline 3D tool. This can be as simple as something made with a poster board. We just want to know how have you used timelines to engage students. So again, story@bdocs.com. Again, great apps for the App Store on their website and then the iOS App Store. Note about some of the reviews that are coming in about their iOS application. David Sparks over at Mac Sparky said, "It is like magic and makes me look brilliant." The USA App Store review, "This app helped me clarify and communicate crucial evidence. It is a godsend for me." Another USA App Store review, "They must have for trainers, teachers, speakers, and lecturers." A UK App Store review, "Timeline 3D for iOS that makes it easy to create and present timelines." So, again, it's a pretty good use case. If you're not even in education, you're just a trainer, maybe you're a corporate trainer, Timeline 3D can be a great tool for you. So, again, it's in the App Store and on their website, bdocs.com. Thanks again for those guys for sponsoring the show. Check them out if you haven't. Pretty funny. I was talking to some of the guys over at bdocs today and about The Hobbit. And we kind of made the joke that they should replace the default sample timeline with a timeline of Middle Earth from the Lord of the Rings era and the Elvish font. So maybe they'll work on that.
Yeah, they'll spend the rest of their life in litigation with the Tolkien estate after that.
Yeah, it's true. So, again, thanks for them sponsoring the show. Story@bdocs.com. You have a chance to win a great contest, and maybe we'll read yours on the show.
Good luck. Cool. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of elaborate a little bit more on what I meant by the thing I just said, which was round-tripping of data between applications. One thing, this kind of came back to me today when I was talking to my beginner class about iPads, was that the Photos app on iOS is an incredibly special app because it's the only one, you know, if we don't count things like contacts and calendar APIs, the Photos app is the only place on the iOS where you have a kind of common file system between multiple different applications. So many apps can put files in, images and videos into the role, and other apps can pull it back out of the role. So it becomes kind of like a hub for image transport. And we can do much more complicated workflows with images on iOS than we can with any other file type because we have this one place where we can interchange documents. So if you ask me, where does iOS need to go next with something like iOS 7? This is top of my list, is to be able to take data in one application, send it out to another for editing, and then have it sent back to the originating application. And that's not something that they're going to just be able to add on or change. There's going to be some developer pain has to happen there, I'm sure. But to me, that's one thing that's kind of holding back iOS as a real productivity tool, is that there's no way to kind of bridge across between sandboxes and different applications. So what I want to do, for example, is I want to have my PDFs in Evernote, send them to PDF Expert, edit them, highlight them, read them, and then when that application saves, the data is sent back to Evernote and that's synced back up to the Evernote cloud. And I think that, to me, that's absolutely top of my list for things, fundamental architectural things that need to happen in iOS to take it to the next level.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot of our things we have on the list here are kind of they're kind of nitpicky stuff, I guess, you know, and we'll go over some of those later. But that is, I mean, I haven't thought about that with the Photos application, because that really is, no matter what application you're in, if you're on Instagram and taking a photo, it goes on the same photos area. It has that centralized solution.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there are kind of features that we would like to see in iOS, but then there's also these underlying conceptual, structural things that iOS either does a poor job of right now, like opening between two applications is a poor substitute because you end up leaving copies lying around everywhere you went. And then there's your features that we want on top. The other one that I wanted to point out was iCloud collaboration. Now, this is a thing that Google is essentially running away with this from Apple right now. I'm not totally convinced that like having two children edit the same text document at the same time is like the pinnacle of computer science achievement in terms of all the things we could do with a computer in the classroom, but it's certainly something that people like. And more than just the act of live collaboration on one document, the idea that we could work together on a document separated and asynchronously in time, that's important. Whether or not it has to happen right there at the same time, you know, two people live editing a word processing document. iCloud at the moment really doesn't attack the problem of you and me sharing data at all. It's essentially they've solved one problem, which is me as a person has five different. I have five different devices. You know, I've got a Mac here, a Mac there, a laptop, a phone, and a tablet. And I would like my files, my contacts, my calendars, and my photo streams to be on all of those devices, right? So it's me to multiple devices, and that part has been solved. You know, needs refinement, but it has been solved. But the part where you and I both work on a Pages document, each on our respective iPads, has simply not even been addressed so far. And I think that's another thing that needs to be looked at quite closely.
And I've got to think they're doing that. I mean, I don't know how they could not be having that discussion internally, because I've been playing with the Google Drive iOS app recently, and it's come a long way. Mm-hmm. You can manage sharing preferences right from within it, and it's in some ways it, you know, again, it doesn't have all the features of a Pages or a Numbers, but it has a lot more. It has some functionality that those don't.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they handle that. I mean, possibly it's just to say this object in the cloud is now accessible to Bradley Chambers, you know, and then that will sync into a folder in your Pages application, and then I can, and then we do the same kind of, you know, oh, I open Pages, oh, there's an update, but it's come from you instead of from me, that kind of thing. Or whether there's some separate way where we say, we'll put this into the sharing pile, you know, when there's a sharing section or whatever. That's a design question, but fundamentally the architectural thing has to happen where you and I can have access to a piece of data stored in iCloud through similar APIs. And it doesn't seem like it's 100 miles away to make that possible. It's just that it hasn't really been attacked yet. The only place where it has sort of been attacked in iCloud is shared photo streams in the Photos application again. And that is good so far as it goes, but my gripe about shared photo streams is that it's not actually shared streams as much as broadcast from one to many. So if I share a stream with you, you can't then put photos into that stream. Am I right on that? I think I'm right on that.
Yeah, it's a one-way thing
with notifications. And for that, it works well. But, you know, my wife and I can't have a shared photo stream of pictures of our kids. We've got two, one from her to me and one from me to her. And that is that kind of thing that I'm thinking, you got to start thinking a bit more high level. And in some ways, my complaints are more about iCloud than they are about iOS. You know, iOS is doing a lot of these things just fine, but it needs the infrastructure in the cloud to enable collaboration, enable sharing, these kind of things. Those are my two big ones. You know, there's other things I would like to see, but certainly I think at a fundamental level, inter-application communication and collaboration through the cloud are two things that iOS really needs to make a big step up on in iOS 7.
I've got a couple things that are, again, these are more nitpicky. I would love to see Delta updates for apps, you know, especially if you're using applications, if you've got students that are updating over the air, and these are some large applications that, you know, if only 10 megs of it change and it's a 500 meg application, it would be great to see Delta updates. Again, we've seen that in the OS updates. You may added one here that I thought was interesting about Newsstand, about how to build magazines without coding, and then, you know, some different user interface, and that could be really powerful. You know, in our realm, that if you could do a quick, you know, if your school newsletter could be a Newsstand application that could be free, you know, it's, you know, kind of no programming experience necessary. Yeah, that could be great.
Yeah, imagine if you were able to publish to Newsstand from iBook Author, for example. You know, because one of the biggest problems, if you look at a lot of Newsstand applications, the biggest problem is, well, one is that the Adobe tools seem to still be producing 500 megabyte magazines, which is insane. But beyond that, one of the big complaints you see if you look at the reviews for Newsstand applications is this magazine crashes all the time. So, like, you know, how do we get into a world where our magazines crash? You know, that's crazy stuff. And so, you know, my book doesn't crash, right? Because the reader is written in by Apple, who know what they're doing, and the content is just delivered as files that are displayed by this application. And it seems to me that there's an opportunity to do something with Newsstand that would certainly take the coding pressure off a lot of these magazines, because because there are some, like Tap Magazine and Marco Arment's magazine, that are doing a very good job. But in the main, the large publishing houses are doing a terrible job of building iOS applications to carry their content. And if Apple could take some of that weight and give them a publishing tool that would let them produce content for that, then A, it would make me a whole lot more interested in Newsstand, but B, it could potentially open up, like you say, to much smaller publishers, schools, for example. You know, get our school magazine, school newsletter through Newsstand and iOS. It would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be great. A couple other things. I'd love to see some more management options for cart deployments. The ability to control push notifications, pin required for shutdown, pin required before shutting down the device or upgrading the OS, things like that. Those are just some small nitpicky things they could easily add in iOS 7. Then again, just some more expansion of iTunes U, perhaps becoming even more of a learning management system. Maybe take it to the next level and kind of kick all the other competitors to the curb.
Yeah, and again, that's a feature that's half in the cloud as well. My biggest wish for iTunes U is really some form of management from iOS, right? Because I do a lot of talks about iTunes U at the moment because we've gone really heavily into it and it's working well for us. But people say, well, come and talk to us about iTunes U. So I show them iTunes U and it's all great and here's all stuff in iOS and here's what you can do with it. And then here's how you get into iTunes U. You go back to your Mac and suddenly there's these like... because nobody wants to hear a story anymore that involves first you have to go back to your desktop computer and then do something there. And if there was some way in iTunes U where a teacher could sort of flip it around like a secret bookcase, and on the back there's actually editing controls for your course, that would be incredibly powerful. And then on the reporting side, a little more analytics that go along with that. Who's been looking at these posts? Who's got unread posts still on their device? That kind of thing. Who's not keeping up with the things that we're sending out?
Reminds me of a link that I saw today, and I think you tweeted it as well, from David Chartier, as I believe how you pronounce it, from Agile Bits Solutions. They make the great application 1Password. But talking about the shrinking list of things that he needs his Mac for. And that really should be a goal when you're looking at, integrating workflows into your school, is don't be limited on just one device. Make it where it can be accessed from anywhere, from any basically Apple device.
Yep, that's the school philosophy right there, teacher productivity. You don't want to make it so that people have to carve out time in their day to comply with something because you've said you can only do it on a computer.
If they're sitting at the doctor's office after school and all they have is their iPad and they've got Wi-Fi at the doctor's office, they should be able to work on their iTunes U course management system and check things in.
Yeah, and one of the other we're going to do another thing back at the school we were training at today next week about iTunes U, and one of the things we're definitely going to talk about is I'm going to use Explain Everything, which is an amazing app for making instructional videos on the iPad. You literally record on the iPad. It's great. But then what's the story? How do I get that into iTunes U? And the story is basically I have to export that file as a video to my Dropbox, which I then access on my Mac, which I then use Safari to upload to iTunes U Course Manager. That's a production pipeline that most teachers are either not going to follow, or they won't understand it, or they won't like it. It's basically the two things that are probably going to happen there. So everything will go fine when I show them Explain Everything, and everything will go fine when I show them Course Manager. But when I show them those steps to go from something I made on my iPad to getting it into Course Manager, that's what I know for a fact, that's when I'm going to lose people. And I think if iTunes U could get an upload API and I could say and Explain Everything, send this straight to iTunes U as a material, that would be killer.
I was setting up an Elmo document camera today for a teacher, and so we putting in a projector in her classroom and a Elmo document camera. Have you ever used those before?
I have not, no.
It's basically a modern-day overhead projector, where so if you've got something, say, in a math textbook, you don't have to use overhead sheets. You just, it's basically a basically a document camera, very, very high quality, can zoom in quite a bit. They're not cheap. They'll run you about $500 plus the cost of the projector. But the thing is, our teachers wear them out, and they're extremely simple. You turn the projector on, you turn the Elmo on, it's got a zoom and an autofocus. It's got a couple other menu settings for brightness and things, but they really don't touch those. It's zoom and autofocus, and that's it. And that's what teachers need. They are, you know, they get to school at 7:30 a.m. They have class that starts at 8:15, so they've got 45 minutes to kind of get prepared. So then if they want to record something and explain everything, they need to be able to record it, hit save, have it be in iTunes U, and have it be done. The whole save it to Dropbox and then go to my Mac and then upload it and then make sure it's there, make sure it works, it's too complicated. It needs to be, you know, record, talk, finish, upload.
Yep. I look forward to the day. Here's hoping. I wanted to roll back to your thing about keep it simple, Bradley, because I think that one of the kind of lines of reasoning that I sometimes hear with this whole thing about where does iOS need to go next often involves people sort of fantasizing that the iPad will become more like a Windows PC. And I think, if I can say, there are some things where iOS absolutely does not need to go. And primary amongst those is iOS does not need to expose a file system to the user. In my opinion, that must never happen again. And regardless of all the, you know, the things that we've complained about inter-application sharing and round-tripping to different applications and so on, whatever solution Apple finds for that has to not be, here's your file system, double-tap this file to open it in whatever application you like. iOS does not need to provide slot-in storage through SD cards. It doesn't need to provide a VGA adapter on the side of the case. It doesn't need to provide, a slot for a USB stick. What it does need to provide is things that are as simple as plugging in a USB stick and saving a file to that place. Right? You know, it has to be as simple as that. But I really strongly believe that it doesn't have to be that. You know, it could be an iCloud. I touch the file. I say, share this with this person, and I pull somebody at my contacts, and that's it. That's how I share files. Something like that. You know, I don't know what the design affordances are for all of that kind of thing, and there are certainly corner cases to be thought about. But it's important not to confuse the ease of use of a USB stick with it's got to be a USB stick, or it's got to be a file system or something like that. And I think that is the, you know, for the newly minted head of design at Apple, Johnny Ive and Craig Federighi and these people, this is their big challenge, is to keep iOS simple enough that it's approachable for new users, but also start to satisfy ever more kind of power-hungry people at the top end of the spectrum, people who, like me, want to ditch their MacBook Air and just have an iPad. How can they satisfy me with that kind of situation? You know, people who want to do more high-end design things, more music tools. You know, will we ever see Logic for iOS, for example? Will we see some of the high-end things? Will we see, you know, a Final Cut Pro for iOS? It's not inconceivable to me that that's possible at some point. Moore's Law, you've got to take into account Moore's Law. We're going to have incredibly powerful iOS devices in 10 years' time. But how, from a design perspective, do they take the simplicity that has brought hundreds of millions of people into this platform that were, you know, they never considered themselves experts or even competent computer users, now consider themselves experts? We talked several shows ago about the pilot test that was done in Scotland with iPads. And let me just remind you of what happened in that pilot, that they asked parents, how do you rate your competence on tablet devices at home? And the vast majority, about 80%, said that they were either competent or skilled users. I forget the exact phrases they used for the responses, but it was something like that, that competent or above was something like 80% of the student body or the parent body thought that they were at that grade with tablet computers. And I don't think you would see anything like that if you asked them, how do you rate yourself on Windows XP or Windows 7 or even Mac OS X? You would not see that kind of overwhelming majority who felt confident, who who felt empowered, who felt they felt like they owned the device rather than the device owning them. And I think that is something precious and something that has to be maintained. And the big, big challenge for the next couple of years is how do you keep that? Well, A, bringing in new users at the low end and keeping the people at the high end. Because what you might see if iOS doesn't go much further is the people at the high end who have kind of redesigned their life and rearranged their data to be able to use an iPad a lot just find, this isn't quite working for me. I'm going to have to start bringing my laptop back in. You know, I'm finding myself too unproductive when I'm traveling, so I need to take the laptop with me or whatever. How do you keep both of those constituencies happy? And that's why Johnny Ive drives a Bentley Brooklands and I don't, because I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure he does.
Well, they always say that simple is much harder. It's easy to be complicated, and simple is harder. So that we've got you know, iOS is a mature platform, but that we've got some things that we'd like to see, and some really there's some work for Apple to do.
There is, you know, in some ways, iOS 6 was a very conservative release. You know, Maps has dominated the fallout from iOS 6, but if you look at it, there aren't that many new capabilities that you have on iOS 6 that you didn't have on iOS 5. There's been a lot of cleaning up. There's been things like, well, now your iMessages that are sent to your phone number now also come to your iPad and vice versa for your email address. And, you know, there's things like that that should, you know, they've completed features that they started in iOS 5. Do not disturb, passbook, things like that are great. But, you know, fundamentally, iOS 6 is the same iOS as iOS 5 was. And okay, the map tiles look different and the routes are different and so on. And now it's got a GPS. But it wasn't as, you know, the switch from iOS 3 to iOS 4 when multitasking came in was far more important to productivity on iOS than switching from iOS 5 to iOS 6, I think. Now, in iOS 6, there are certainly a lot of low-down APIs that are very, very important, and we will certainly see within, you know, 6 months from now probably, apps coming out for iOS 6 only that are incredibly powerful and are much more advanced than the apps we've got right now. But that's in the hands of developers. What Apple hasn't done is they haven't necessarily given us high-level OS capabilities that the user can see as a new thing that I can do. It hasn't enabled new workflows yet. Maybe that'll just come from the apps, but maybe it'll have to come from Apple giving us some things like collaboration through iCloud, inter-app sharing between different silos, things like that. I think those are going to be the next big, big steps for iOS.
Moving out of adolescence, becoming an adult, I guess could be an analogy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't see, one thing I was going to ask you, what do you think of this, but like running two apps at once in iOS, is that something people want? You know, Surface is starting to offer that. Some of the Samsung skins on Android are starting to offer that. Doesn't do it for me, I have to say.
If I had a 15-inch iPad, maybe, but not at the current screen sizes. I just enjoy the simplicity of having one app, and it's so easy to switch. You can double tap, and then you tap again, and you're there. I don't. Mm-hmm. You know, I just enjoy having the full screen. You know, especially if you're in an app that has a keyboard. The keyboard already takes up half the screen.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to figure out in my head what is my kind of problem with, you know, two apps on a tablet screen. And I think what I kind of feel about it is that when you do that, you sort of break the illusion that iOS gives you. You know, when you open iBooks, there's an illusion that you're reading a book. You know, when you open the DJ application and there's two decks there, you've got a sort of illusion that you're mixing on two decks. You know, you bring up GarageBand, there's an illusion that you're playing a real instrument because that's what's filling the screen. The phrase I've used for this in the past is that the iPad becomes the thing you do with it. And I think when you start to be able to click together two applications, yes, you will get possibly a small benefit in productivity. You know, you can see one thing, you can write another thing, you know, and who hasn't at times wanted to be able to see the web page you were looking at and write in another note-taking application at the same time? But to do that, to give up that kind of wonderful adaptability of the device through software in order to have that slight convenience. I'm not sure that that's not an easy trade-off to make. It's not an obvious no-brainer to me that slotting together two applications is going to is not going to take away some of the fundamental kind of essence of iOS, which is that this plain piece of glass becomes whatever it is you decide to run on it. It can become a game, it can become whatever. Now, of course, you don't have to run two applications side by side if you don't want to, but there's just something about the way iOS works right now that I think is incredibly appealing to new users and return users alike, and it would be very, I would be very loath to just give that up without an awful lot of thought.
Then you would be trying to resize Windows, and it's, no, I agree. It's better the way it is.
It's wonderful the way it is.
I agree.
But it could be better.
Do you want to talk about, I know we've both been demoing OpenDNS Umbrella. Do you want to talk about your experiences real quick?
Yeah, really briefly. We before OpenDNS Umbrella came out, we sort of talked about how OpenDNS were doing a new thing, and we didn't sort of know what it was yet. And essentially what Umbrella turns out to be is it's not a self-balancing scooter that can run forever. But what is it's a cloud-based VPN solution where the traffic from your device, when your device goes off your school network, the traffic from that device will be routed through OpenDNS's VPN servers in the cloud. And then the traffic will be subject to the same filtering at home or at McDonald's or Starbucks or wherever as it would be if it was in your school. So it's a way in which you can kind of provide filtering that goes with the device rather than, you know, filtering for the network, and when the device goes off network, you're on your own, basically. Now, the way it works at the moment is not absolutely ideal for schools, because what happens is when you enroll an iOS device, you are sent a configuration profile, which is, they're doing it the absolute right way. That's what you do. You want to do this by configuration profile. But two things happen with that. One, the profile will deliver both an automatic VPN payload and a manual VPN payload. And say you want to circumvent OpenDNS Umbrella right now, all you do is you go into your settings, go into VPN, and say, oh, I just want to use the manual VPN. And then you just turn it off. And that's it. You're not going through their cloud anymore. So what I think they need to do is they need to split that off and say, well, you know, I only want to have these devices be able to have automatic VPN. Okay, so that's one thing. I don't want people to be able to turn it off and turn it on optionally. I want it to be on all the time. And secondly, they need a way in which you can put a removal passcode into the profile before it's sent to the user, so that when they install it, they won't be able to remove it without your authorization. And I've been talking to their development team about that, and they were very receptive to my ideas on that. And I certainly hope that those things will become possible, because in my testing, I've had it on my iPad mini for a good few weeks now, and there's rarely been a reason why I've had to turn it off. I just run with it on all the time, and it's performance-wise, it's great. I haven't noticed any issues with going to, for example, Apple's content delivery network. Sometimes what happens is if I, in Scotland, get routed to a VPN server in Canada, for example, then the Apple, it looks to Apple like my traffic's coming from Canada, and they put me on a Canadian Edge server rather than a UK one, and the result is a slow download from the iTunes store. I haven't noticed anything like that. I think they've got enough servers, at least close to me, where that doesn't seem to be much of a problem. So I know you've been testing it as well, Bradley, and I think you're pretty happy with it too.
Yeah, the speed has been great. I'm a big fan of OpenDNS in general outside of this service. Outside of the things you mentioned, I would love to see, I don't know, I don't want to say cheaper plan, but maybe less expensive plan, because when I'm looking to try to outfit this with, you know, quite a few iPads, the cost does go up dramatically. And I know right now they're kind of in some ways still looking at enterprise, you know, that kind of mindset. And I would love it. And I get this question all the time from our parents to say, hey, I'm getting my kid an iPad or an iPhone for graduation. How do I secure them? And say, well, when you're at home, you can do OpenDNS Family Shield, but when they're on the go, you know, shrug your shoulders. There's nothing you can do. And this really is a great solution. So I would love to see a $10 a year kind of family plan or, you know, home plan, because this is, you know, this becomes an issue as more and more kids get 3G and 4G LTE enabled devices, you want to make sure they're not getting on content you don't want them to get on. Mm-hmm. And this is an easy way to do it. But again, for first step, it's wonderful. Much more than we had a month ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. For a 1.0 product and service, I think it's fantastic. And if they can get the delivery to iOS right for schools, and if they can get the pricing right for schools, then I think they're onto something that I'm certainly going to be talking about that a lot as one possible solution amongst a few others that are there.
So, yeah, I'm happy with it overall. We'll see what the next few months bring to it. But, again, I'm glad we have options. OpenDNS is a great company. Use them at home. We have their enterprise plan here internally, and I found the content filtering to be much better than the one from SonicWall, and SonicWall costs twice as much.
Yeah, I had a cause to talk to our upper secondary school today, and we just had a kind of broad conversation around technology, and I said, what do you think of the web filtering in the school? And they were kind of like, well, what web filtering, you know? And I said, so are you telling me that you don't really bump into the filters on a day-to-day basis in the classroom? And they said, no, we don't. You know, we just do our thing. We do the stuff the teacher wants us to do. We do our research, and we don't. It's not a big issue in my school. And I know it is a massive issue in a lot of other schools. It's just the sort of angst that goes around things being filtered and not filtered and wasn't filtered last week and now it's filtered this week and all this kind of stuff. And I think alongside, you know, this is another theme that we have in this podcast, is alongside the culture of use, getting the technology at the right level and getting those two things in the right balance and the right perspective is absolutely essential. And there's no, again, in one of our themes, there's no one answer for that. But there are several good answers and there are several bad answers. And if people are angry all the time about what you're doing with web filtering, then you've not got that right. And that's kind of the way I feel about that, is that I'm happy to see that our web filtering is working. I can look at the logs and see that it's working. It's catching adware. It's catching the occasional attempts. But for the most part, people are getting their work done, and the things that are going through are what we want to go through.
That's a good kind of rule of thumb, is that it should be, you know, strong enough to catch the deliberate attempts, but just general day-to-day stuff, you know, your average user shouldn't run into your filter too much.
Yeah, and I think I keep making this analogy with safety culture in safety critical industries. You know, I used to be involved a little bit in railway safety, and one of the things that used to happen in when planes crashed and when trains crashed was that, oh, let's just blame the driver, right? Because it's the driver's fault. But in technological systems like that, and like the internet as well, it's not always quite as simple as that. And if what we've managed to engender in our school is a system by where you can, like, things may happen, but if those things are sort of, I don't want to say confessed, but at least, you know, reported to the teacher honestly as an honest mistake. I made this mistake. Here's what happened. This is what popped up. Then there's a conversation could be had. There's learning that can happen there. And that's what's taken, you know, in the UK railways from reasonably safe, but occasionally, you know, a disaster happens situation to a much more mature attitude towards risk and blame than typically just blaming the driver all the time. And blaming the driver of the iPad for things that the internet does to them, I think, is also counterproductive. And it's all about putting that culture in that goes along with the technology. You know, we can build interlocks for our trains that will stop them all the time, but people behave around those things, and that becomes the way that people behave, and their behavior is modified by the systems that are there to prevent their behavior. Whereas if you can build a culture that drives behavior rather than the technology driving the behavior, that can be really, really powerful.
It's kind of like when you go bowling and they have the bumpers on the side. You know, those mm-hmm. are the technology is there as a safety net, but it's not the be all end all. It is the mindset of the users and the mindset of the organization.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, good show, I think.
Yeah. We're hitting the hour mark there. We've managed to shave your usual extra 20 minutes off this week.
Be back next week. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Don't forget the contest.
a contest story at bdocs.com. Thanks again for bdocs for sponsoring the show. Again, if you've not checked out their great iPhone and iPad application, Timeline 3D, you need to do that right now. We'll have links to some things we talked about in the show notes, outofschool.net, or if you're using Downcast or Instacast or another podcatching device, they should appear in line. I'm on the web, chambersdaily.com, and on Twitter and app.net at Bradley Chambers.
Spears.org on the web for me, and Fraser Spears on Twitter. I've also recently been getting into Google Plus a little bit more, and Google Plus just rolled out a new communities feature. I've kicked off an educational technology community on Google Plus. If you just search for that, there's some initial chat. We've got about 112, 115 people there so far. And most of the threads so far have been sort of discussions around bring your own device and so on. But if you want to get involved in that, just go ahead and search for educational technology on Google Plus.
And again, we always appreciate positive reviews on iTunes. Helps new people find the show. And as always, tell your friends. And thanks for listening.